This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What would it be like if you were to walk into your home and see a robot cooking dinner? Would it be strange if it asked you about your day? Or reminded you to call your mother? Or nagged you about watching too many football games? Many researchers envision a future where robots like this are part of our daily lives, helping us complete tasks like washing dishes or playing the role of companions. And to help robots interact with people, researchers want to create robots with personalities. These social robots would understand social skills and express emotions. Special robots have been the stuff of science fiction, from the Twilight Zone robotic companions. There are a whole lot of Twilight Zone episodes with robots as companions. Perhaps you remember Data on Star Trek, who tried as he might to adopt human emotions. But what are the technical challenges to creating these types of robots? And how lifelike do we want these machines to be? Maybe they'll be too lifelike and we'll get annoyed with them. What do you think? Here to talk to us about the commercial robots available today and what is being planned for the future is Helen Greiner. She is co-founder and chairman of the board of iRobot. That is the company that brings us the Roomba vacuum cleaner. She joins us from Massachusetts. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Oh, thanks for the invite again.
You're welcome. Also joining us is computer scientist Peter McGowan. Dr. McGowan is a professor at the University of London. He is project coordinator of the group Living with Robots and Interactive Companions. And last week, this group of European researchers launched a year-long project aiming to develop robots with personalities. Dr. McGowan joins us from the UK. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira. Why, pleasure to be with you.
You're welcome. Why do we want robots with personalities?
What we believe is that by being able to develop robots that have personalities, that we're going to be able to make the sorts of technologies that we want to use in our life easier to use. So as human beings, we tend to interact very well with other human beings, and the idea is to try and give robots and other sorts of technologies at least the beginnings of some type of personality, some type of quality of interaction there, where you feel that there's a companionship being built between you. But I think it's worth saying at this stage that we're not actually building robots that are going to be able to kind of help you do the ironing and so on just yet. But we're beginning to try to develop some ideas about how we can make technologies, robots, and also kind of graphical characters interesting enough in the interactions with them that you believe that they have some form of companionship with you.
But might we have these robots that don't have the personalities we like? I mean, do we run that risk?
Well, no, because what we would ensure, obviously, in doing this is that the companions that they are the sorts of companions that you want to have. There would be no point in developing a technology that made life more difficult. So clearly, we'd want to be producing personalities that made life altogether more. More enjoyable.
1-800-999-8255 is our number, talking about robots with personalities. Also, if you're in Second Life, you can find us in Second Life Island. Also, starting today, teenagers can find us on Science Friday and Teen Grid in Second Life. That's at the I4U Alliance Island. Helen, tell us about your robots. Do you find any need to make your vacuum cleaner have a personality?
Some of our users believe they already do. Customers have told me for many years about naming their robots. I think they buy them as appliances. You know, they want to get the vacuuming done, but they get them home, and they negotiate around the furniture. They back up from stairs. They communicate with bleeps and bloops. They go back to the charging station and power themselves or eat. You know, I wish my cell phone could do that because I keep forgetting to charge it. And people have had this type of experience before with our pets in their home, so they start giving them names.
Right.
In fact, Georgia Tech just did a study, and they found that 2/3 of the people who Roomba uses actually give them names.
Well, wouldn't it be nice to be able to say to your Roomba, hey, you missed a spot over there, and it goes over there to, and says, thank you very much, I appreciate that, or something like that.
You would think so. Our Roombas actually know when they're picking up dirt, and they stay in the same place using intelligent algorithms. They can do that spot for longer. We do focus groups on our customers, and people say they want that kind of feature, but when you ask them how much are you going to pay for it, it's really not as much yet as the cost it would take to add that kind of feature to the robots. Mm-hmm.
Peter, are people looking for just a substitute for their pet or something like that?
It's interesting hearing what was being said there about the robotic cleaner and the fact that it emits kind of beeps and blops as it kind of wanders around. And clearly, one of the reasons that it's so successful is that people do anthropomorphize. They give kind of human-like properties to something which is actually a very good piece of technology, but it's doing very simple things. And so the point there is that seems to make that technology more enjoyable to work with, to be around. One of the things we're doing in this project is we have a group of people who study the behavior of dogs and how humans and dogs interact with one another. So we're looking at the sorts of things that make a relationship with a pet dog, for example, a fulfilling relationship, and trying to see if we can take some of those ideas and build them into the way that the robots will interact with humans, so as to kind of build that link. We're not building a robotic dog, but we're going to try and take some of the lessons that we can learn about how you build a relationship with a pet and build those into the robots.
And how do you give a robot a personality or emotion? How do you build it in?
There are this research is at a very early stage. One of the issues clearly though is that for an entity, be it a robot or another human being, for that example, for them to manifest any kind of personality, it means that they're reacting to you in an individualized way. So you've got to be able to recognize, for example, the expression on a person's face or the body posture that they have, how they're positioning themselves with respect to you in the kind of social spaces. Mm-hmm. And so we can start to build computer vision systems that recognize, for example, whether somebody is smiling or frowning and whether or not they're the distance that they are and so on. So you can begin to have some kind of meaningful input from the kind of vision point of it. Also looking at the tone of people's voices as they're speaking, whether or not they're sounding happy or sad. So you've got those inputs coming into it. And then the question is, how do you relate those inputs to the actual behavioral outputs? And that really is mediated by the personality that you're building into it. So the robot is aware of some element of your emotional state and is then able to act accordingly. So it may be that when you're sounding annoyed and looking unhappy, then the robot will then go off into a corner and quietly wait until you're in a slightly better mood to interact with them, which is what you would expect maybe a human companion mm-hmm. who realized that you were having a bad day and was just going to kind of not bother to kind of get in your way and under your feet. And so that's the kind of way that you do it. We look at for something called semantic cues from the environment, something that tells us a little bit about the human being's emotional state.
Do we want the robot to look like us or a pet, or does it have to have a face? Or?
This is a very, very interesting question, and it's one that a great deal of research is actually being done on. There's some classic research that was done in Japan, and it produced some interesting results, and something called the Uncanny Valley. So it turns out that if you have robots that look look like robots, they seem to be more acceptable to more people than robots that look too humanoid. If you move up to the kind of Mr. Data type androids, and those aren't functioning as perfect human beings, then people find them actually quite difficult to be around, because they people report things like feeling that they're in the presence of a zombie. So it looks like a human being, but it's not doing exactly what a human being would want. So our robots aren't going to look anything like human beings. We're building robots that look like robots, but giving them the ability, for example, to have a something which you can identify as a face, from which you can then take your cues from the robot's face. So that there'll be some way of being able to indicate the linkage with the robot through it having a kind of face and possibly like the bleeping noises that the robot cleaner uses.
I think Peter's right, because before we put the Roomba on the market, we ran focus groups to see if people wanted robot vacuum cleaners, and people would imagine, you know, like a humanoid robot pushing a vacuum. Mm. Most people said, no, not in my house.
Yes.
That is kind of creepy, and also, where would I store it?
You know, so, very good,
you know, we
point.
We have a little Roomba, and it goes under the couches and under the bed, so we can the job done more effectively because it's small, and you know, people can actually have it in their house and feel comfortable with it.
So you don't want your customers to confuse it with being a human or having a personality?
It's not having a personality because, you know, I was inspired by R2-D2 myself, and he has a lot of personality, but it doesn't have to be a human personality. I'll give you another story. Sometimes we get customer support calls, and, you know, if they say they have a problem and the robot's still under warranty, we'll say, send it back, and they'll say, no, replace it, not Rosie. You know, she's my robot. So, you know, I swear they expect us to come to the door in an ambulance, perform open-ship surgery on their robots, and... you know, this really is a whole new class of machine, and I'm glad that universities, people like Peter's team, are jumping in and studying really what's going on here. And, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing the results.
And I think it's fair also to point out that part of this research not only is about building the robots, but it's actually trying to understand what makes a relationship, what gives something a piece of technology a feeling, something called agency, that it seems to have a kind of an internal view of the world, of the way it interacts with you. There's a beautiful experiment that I remember reading about that was done about 10 or 15 years ago, where they had a computer screen that had a series of squares and circles on it, and the squares and circles just moved around randomly. And
Peter, I'm gonna have to interrupt and tell you to hold that thought, or else we'll never hear the end of it.
Okay.
Because we have to go to a break, but sounds like a great story, and I don't want to have to interrupt you right at the punchline. So stay with us. We'll be right back talking more about robots with Peter McGowan and Helen Greiner. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about social robots, robots with personalities. Maybe you'd like to have one working for you, with Peter McGowan and Helen Greiner. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. And when I rudely interrupted Peter, he was telling us a story about social circles and squares, was it?
Circles and squares, yes. So the screen showed these shapes just moving around randomly, and people were asked to tell the scientists what they actually saw. And the way that they reported that was, well, the squares were being chased by the circles, and then the circles went and kind of hid in the top corner, and then the squares kind of chased them up and round. And what that shows is that even something very, very simple, like a kind of random set of moving patterns, we tend to see some kind of pattern in there, in part because we like stories. As human beings, one of the things we've evolved over a period of time to do is to pass information on through a kind of narrative, through a story. Mm-hmm. So we tend to anthropomorphize technologies and things a great deal. And even if you've got something very simple, like these kind of moving shapes, you still see them as having some form of character. The squares were the good guys, and the circles were the bad guys, for example. And I just think that's a very interesting experiment, because it's such a simple thing to do, and yet people see this as being there's a real battle being fought out there between the squares and the circles.
Pam in Aberdeen, Idaho. Hi, welcome to Science Friday, Pam.
Hi, Ira. Hey, my question is, will the people that are working on this be designing their robot, keeping the geriatric population in mind, since all of us baby boomers are continuing to reach retirement age? So in other words, like, would it be a more hi-fi, clap on, clap off, or help I've fallen, you know, that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually one of the application areas we're looking at is assistance for people who want to remain in their home and have some kind of companion helper in there. So the nice thing about a robot is that if we design it such that you feel comfortable with it, is that that robot can not only do physical tasks, but it also can interface to the electronics in your home and also through the internet to other places. Mm-hmm. So it can provide information to you, provide a kind of channel by which you get information that's important to you coming through that way, and provide you with kind of assistance and the ability to be there and check that, you know, the lights are switched off on the back porch and that you've taken your tablets when you were supposed to.
Thanks, Pam.
All right, great, thanks.
You're welcome. Why not the whole house as a robot? You know, I'm thinking of HAL in 2001, yes. A Space Odyssey, which is 40 years old this month. Can you believe that?
It's amazing. That is actually, yes, we're also looking at developing exactly that, something that we're calling at the moment the spirit of the house. So the idea is that there is your wired house has lots of technology in it, and as you're moving, so for example, your companion entity may download itself into the robot for a period of time, and then later on when you go upstairs, because robots tend to not be very good going upstairs, the same companion will load itself into, for example, a computer in your in another room of your house, but you'll be able to identify that even though it's in a different body. It's not in the robot body, it's now on the kind of computer screen in front of you as a computer graphics character, that you'll be able to identify something about it being the same entity, the same mm-hmm. agent that you mm-hmm. that you've built this relationship with. And these are really fascinating questions. Will it work? We're not quite sure, because you're taking something from a situation where it's embodied, as it's the technical term, it's embodied as a robot with the ability to move around in three-dimensional space, as opposed to it being on a kind of two-dimensional screen. So these are some of the questions we're looking at.
I found that smart homes haven't entirely caught on. But, you know, as Peter said, while robots are embodied, you know, you know if the robot's in a room with you, you know what it's doing there. And we're actually just going into beta testing on a virtual visiting robot. Mm. That's an internet-connected robot, as Peter was saying. We'll be in beta testing this year. And, you know, you can log onto it from anywhere in the world, and you can see what the robot sees, you hear what it hears, and you can drive it wherever you want to go. And, you know, you can use it to check on your pets, see what your kids are doing, see that your home is secure, and, you know, make sure your elderly grandmother is taking her meds. As you said, the elderly demographic is a market that we are are targeting.
Does it look like a person?
No, it doesn't look like a person. No, we don't believe it has to either get the job done or to have a personality and to have quality interactions with people.
Are you building a personality into this?
This one will take on, it's being controlled by somebody on the outside, so it will become them when they're logged on to it. Mm. But there's no reason the same microprocessor can't start to have a personality, and we look at that for future generations.
Mm-hmm. So you could actually speak through it from a distance?
And, mm-hmm. You can. It's like you're there, except it's when you have to be away from home.
And I guess it could have a GPS in it to know exactly where it is in the house or something like that.
And kind of a location system.
Yeah, location system.
But, you know, even today, you know, we're speaking about the elderly. People tell me that they buy Roomba for their elderly relatives because they find it a challenge to lug out a vacuum and push it around. And that, you know, helps people remain more independent. And that's one of the things that, you know, Peter and his group are looking at. How many more ways can robots help people remain more independent?
Well, you know, we're going to have Dean Kamen coming on in a few minutes. Maybe he'll help you make it walk upstairs.
That would be neat.
Well, he's got that wheelchair that does that. 1-800-989-8255 is a number talking about robots. Let's see if we can get a call or two in. Nancy in Louisville. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks. Love this topic since I read iRobot years and years ago.
I love the book.
I work with high school students, and it's senioritis time, and I'm wondering if perhaps there's value in robots that were not as pleasant, that they might, for example, teach behavior, sort of do behavior modification. In other words, they would be as recalcitrant, perhaps, as some of those students are.
other positive feedback from the robots would be the way to go. Maybe if you want to help you want help quitting smoking, the robot could remind you, the positive health benefits of that, or losing weight or anything. I think positive reinforcement is the way to go from robots.
I was thinking also that, you know, positive when you were positive and negative when you were negative. In other words, it could teach good behavior.
There's also remember there's a robot that if you want to know what it's like to have a baby, it acts as a baby.
Oh, we have those actually at my school on the kids. It's really good for them. It's pretty creepy actually, but
the uncanny valley again.
And I do have a bigger question about educational uses of it. You've talked about the elderly. What about with kids? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for calling, Nancy.
Well, we find that when kids learn with robots, they get excited about studying engineering and sciences.
Absolutely, yes.
So what we've done is we've made a developer's version of our rugged little reliable Roomba base, and it's being used today by researchers at CMU, MIT, USC, and Brown, but it's also been adopted by Bopple, which is a K-12 program. And they teach kids computer skills and engineering through robot designing programming. And, it reaches over 5,000 kids today. And there's also, in the Boston Museum of Science, a PhD from Northeastern, they've set up a tangible computing interface where kids as young as four, they can go up to a robot and teach it to program, to program it by putting blocks in certain order the way they want their software flow to operate. And we believe that that's going to encourage the next generation of technologists, including our future iRobot employees.
Well, you could not have made my introduction any easier for me, because we're going to spend the next few minutes talking about teenagers and robots and robotic contests and having kids interested in it, because there is a great robotic contest that just finished.
With 5 seconds, Thunder Chicken's going up with 3, 2, 1. It looks like a bonus at the buzzer.
Picture an arena, 60,000 screaming fans.
Unbelievable.
Blaring rock music, flashing multicolored lights, and going head-to-head in the middle of the ring are robots.
We'll get the official score with any penalties in just a moment as we try to crown the champions of the first robotics competition, First Overdrive 2008.
This was the atmosphere at the First Robotics World Championship held last weekend at the Georgia Dome in Atlanta. Thousands of kids from around the world competing to see whose bot was best. And that competition is in its 16th year. It was founded by inventor Dean Kamen. Dean is also founder of DEKA Research and Development Corporation, which invents quality of life technologies. And if you'd like to see a video of the competition, you're welcome to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, and you can watch the action as you listen to us talk about it here. A little bit later in the hour, we're going to be joined by a member of one of the winning first teams. So stick around for that. Dean Kamen joins us from Manchester, New Hampshire, to talk about FIRST, which former President Bush described as the WWF for smart people. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dean.
It's great to be here. I'm glad you have that quote. We're trying to make it our tagline.
Is that right? It sounded just like that from that little bit of audio we just listened to.
That line really brought the house down, especially as it just came blurting out of a former president of the United States.
And is that part of the intrigue of this to teenagers? It sounds like something that they would normally love to be involved in.
It's astounding. You get there, and it is just, by any metric, whether it's the Super Bowl or the World Series or the Final Four, it is the most exciting sporting event you can attend, and you don't need to put any, except that it's science, or except that it's technology, or except that it's a science fair. In the unlimited class of exciting competitions, we win.
Mm-hmm. You've been running this for 16 years. You've now gotten 31,000 kids, 23 schools involved. Did you ever envision it growing this big?
Actually, I envisioned it and still envision it growing much bigger. I think it's critical that FIRST be something that is available to every kid in this country. They all need the option to see, while they're still young enough to make career decisions, that science and technology and engineering and problem solving is every bit as exciting, rewarding, fun as bouncing a ball or anything else they put their passion to. Every kid deserves the opportunity to participate in FIRST.
Let me ask my other guests, Helen Greiner and Peter McGowan, is this something you would love to have had when you were a teen?
Absolutely, yes. I'm always impressed at the enthusiasm that young kids show, particularly with robots, because it really is kind of seen as a cool and exciting thing to do. And the more that we can get young people interested in the science and the engineering parts of things, then the better. It's something I spend a lot of my time doing, is going out to schools and running events to try and make people excited about science, because it really is absolutely critical. So kudos to you for doing it. It's wonderful stuff.
I was inspired myself to go to MIT because I saw the precursor to the first contest, which was a contest between MIT students. So it's made a huge difference in my life. I love going to FIRST and just feeling the excitement and the atmosphere. Kids excited about engineering and science, and kids excited about robots. I gotta love that.
Yeah, Dean, wasn't there a study done that looked at how kids participating in FIRST were affected in the long run?
Yeah, it's so staggering that if I quote from it, you won't believe me anyway. I'd encourage you to go to the FIRST website and look at it. But basically, in every category of things like will they stay in school relative to peers in an equivalent school situation, will they go on to college, will they choose engineering careers, in every category that peer equivalent high school kids were matched between kids that participated in FIRST and kids that didn't, the difference wasn't a factor of 3%, 4%, 5%. It was a factor of 3 times more likely, 4 times more likely, 6 times more likely to do the things that we all think they ought to be doing. The data is just so compelling, you'd have to be numb not to want to put FIRST in every school you could reach.
We're talking about robotics this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, talking about the future of robots. Let me ask you, Dean, to chime in on something we've been discussing, and that is personalities of robots. As someone who invents robots, your Segway personal transporter is very popular. Do you think that as part of your competition, you might change it from sort of who can knock the other competitor out to who can make a more human-like robot?
Well, I was listening to some of that. I think what most people, and it amazes me that they don't understand, is just how good humans are.
Absolutely.
At projecting their own likes and dislikes into almost anything and making it anthropomorphic. That's why you don't give away your old shoes. They become part of you. So it doesn't take much to make something look, quote, real and animated and human. You know, kids start with teddy bears, and all you have to do is put a couple of squiggles of just the right shape on a white piece of paper, just the shape of that curve here or there, and, oh, that's Donald Duck or that's Mickey Mouse. The fact that we can take very, very, very vague, abstract references to something and make it anthropomorphic should make it pretty easy to believe that if engineers actually intend to make stuff that really looks and acts human, do so, it will be very easy, in fact almost unavoidable, even if it's unintentional, to make people start to think that machines have feelings and are getting more and more lifelike all the time.
Mm-hmm. So you think it's unavoidable?
I think it's unavoidable.
Yeah.
I think it's, again, it doesn't matter whether you intentionally do it or not. It's just an ability humans have to project what they want. I think, not to get into the religious side, but I think almost in that same vein, a great quote by Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, was, God created man in his own image, and man being a gentleman returned the favor. I think we can project almost anything to be human-like. You know, a couple of pieces of soft material suddenly become a cuddly little living thing, and we even project what God looks like as a human with a beard and a staff.
1-800-989-8255. And, of course, you decided to do a robotic competition rather than a math competition because you like to tinker with things.
No, I thought we would use robots because it is so easy to make them photogenic and to put them in an environment that kids understand, a competition, whether it's football or basketball or soccer, a robot running around, accomplishing a goal by scoring points. It just seemed to us that in a culture that's obsessed with competitive sports and visually exciting acts that happen quickly, why not get kids into science and technology by turning the science and technology into something that looks remarkably like other sports? And as I said before, it doesn't take much to to make a human see something that's not quite human as getting close and being animated. So we decided we could make the robots take the place of humans, and it would attract a lot of kids that might not otherwise think about science and technology and problem solving as a fun way to spend their time.
Now, Dean, you've been adding more autonomy to these robot contests.
Yeah, for a lot of reasons. Number one, that's to a lot of people where robotics is going. It's all about the sensors, whether it's distance sensors or object sensing or differentiating things or space or people. And the sensors are getting better and cheaper, and the software is getting easier to, you know, drag and drop whole programs that can sense things and distance and speed. But we add that each year because we always
Hang on, Dean. We have to take a break.
Yep.
So, as I most rudely do to everyone, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking this hour about robots and robots that may have personalities, robots that are more autonomous, with my guests, Dean Kamen, inventor and founder of FIRST Robotics Competition, Helen Greiner, who is a co-founder and chairman of the board of iRobot, and Peter McGowan, who is professor at the University of London and project coordinator of the group Living with Robots and Interactive Companions. Our number, 1-800-999-8255. And when I rudely interrupted Dean, he was talking to us about a comment that Helen had made about his robots becoming more autonomous.
Well, I think Helen brings up a great point, which is, you know, what really will make robots seem to people to be totally animated, real, living, thinking things is the fact that they can respond to their environment, whether it's light or sound or distance or smell or temperature. Mm-hmm. And the sensors that are making that possible are getting simpler and easier and cheaper to make and sell, and the software to interface with them to have them do things is getting simpler to implement. And we, as she points out, each year try to put more and more of that into our robot kits because we want the kits to always be fresh and new and on the edge, and we want returning veterans to our program to always see new, exciting stuff that raises the bar on what can be done while we continue to keep the baseline of the kit accessible and fun for all the rookies that come in each year that are playing the game for the first time. So you need a very, very large dynamic range of capabilities in the kit, and sensors are where we've been focusing for the last few years, and I think we'll continue to focus for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're now going to bring in, we heard a little bit before about the contest. We heard a little bit of audio from the FIRST Robotics Contest, and now joining us is 18-year-old Grant Cox. Grant is a member of the Thunder Chickens. You heard that before. That was one of the winning FIRST teams. He's a senior at Eisenhower High School in Michigan, where he's also he also goes to a magnet school for math and science. He's on the phone with us today from Shelby Township, Michigan. Welcome to Science Friday, Grant.
Hi, nice to be here.
What made you join a robotics competition?
Well, at the magnet school you mentioned, we don't really have, you know, football teams and such, but we are very involved in our robotics team. And it's just always been something, you know, I've always been interested in technology, and I'm a very competitive, outgoing person. And it just seemed like the perfect fit, so I gave it a shot and ended up loving it.
Tell us about your robot design. What did you have to do or have it do?
Well, each year they put out a new, the GDC puts out a new game. This year's game was called FIRST Overdrive. It involved picking up a 40-inch exercise ball and hurtling it over a 6-foot overpass while driving around a track not unlike a NASCAR track. Mm-hmm. We came up with a pretty unique design for grabbing the ball with just these huge arms, and it can actually, at fully extended, it raises up to about 14 feet from a stowed position of about 5 feet. And it was a big design challenge. They have different regulations that they use, and one of the main ones was that no horizontal dimension of the robot could be more than 80 inches, and the ball is 40 inches. So it's a big design challenge there.
Hmm. That's interesting. In fact, we have a video of the competition on our site at sciencefriday.com and of your machine doing that sort of stuff. Say hello to Dean Kamen. You ever met Dean before?
I haven't. nice to be on the phone with you, sir.
And that's congratulations for winning, and thank you for participating and helping us raise the bar every year to make this more competitive and more exciting.
Well, thank you for the phenomenal program that you guys have put together.
How did you come up with Thunder Chickens?
That's a common question. We started in 1999, and back then we were Team Macomb, which was we were just a conglomerate of a bunch of schools in Macomb County. And then we started to branch off and form other teams, and our team, the 217, became more localized to just the Utica Community Schools District and the MST you mentioned. So we wanted to come up with a more personalized name. We had several engineers from Ford Motor Company, one of our major sponsors, and they were working on the Thunderbird engine. And I guess the engineer joke was, since it was slightly underpowered, they called it the Thunder Chicken. And we just thought it was a fun name.
Mm-hmm. And where do you expect to go after you're done here?
Me personally?
Yes.
Yeah,
you're a senior. You're heading to someplace for robotics work?
Yeah, well, I'm planning to enroll in Michigan Tech in the fall for mechanical engineering. I had the opportunity to have a summer internship at Fanuc Robotics and work with top mechanical engineers there. And it was really fascinating stuff. So I'm really looking forward to pursuing a career in that.
You know, it's interesting that there is, it's almost, I think it's a, WWF is an apt description. It's a sort of a combination of a rock concert, the Super Bowl, and a SmackDown.
That's a pretty good way to describe it.
You know,
it really is.
All at the same time. But it also is, you know, it's giving attention to science and technology, which hardly ever gets any attention in the public. Right, Grant?
Right. Well, that's one of the main things. Each year, Dean puts out his quote-unquote homework that we have to do. And this year's Dean's homework was to get FIRST more into the media. And we've been really working hard to do that. FIRST is a great opportunity for students from all fields, from all, you know, social groups, to get exposed to this technology, this engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, we're working to get more coverage, get it more into the public eye. And it's becoming pretty mainstream, I think, at least.
We've been talking about this hour before you joined us about making robots appear more human-like, give them feelings, socializing.
Right.
Would you agree with that? Would you like them to feel more like people?
I was listening in. I think Dean was right. That is a clear direction that things are going. I mean, everybody's seen the movies, you know, where the robots take over the world. But I really think that I've seen some of the stuff that Dean's group comes up with. I've seen some of the stuff, you know, groups like DARPA come up with. And robots are becoming more and more intelligent, more and more lifelike each day. And I definitely think it's a positive direction. You know, having a robotic companion, you know, I think in, you know, X number of years is going to be just as common as having a cat or a dog.
Mm-hmm. Helen, I know you do defense work with, I'm sure it's super secret robotic stuff.
Some of it is.
I'm sure that if a robot is sitting next to you in a foxhole, you want it to be a dependable, trustworthy one.
Well, we've delivered over 1,500 robots to the military now, and they've been used on tens of thousands of missions, and one of the things I'm most proud of is that they've been credited with saving the lives of dozens and dozens of soldiers. They go out and they dispose of IEDs or improvised explosive devices instead of sending one of our troops up to these mm-hmm. dangerous roadside bombs. So it's a great field for robots. That the home robot field and the surgical robot field are the ones as a market have really been significant in the past few years.
Cameron in Tulsa, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I'm a member of a group called Humans United Against Robots, and what we do is we make people aware of incidents like recently in South Africa, there was a military training accident where six soldiers were killed because the gun turned on them. And also I read this week about a military program in Iraq that was scrapped because the robots kept pointing at the soldiers. And I'd like to know what's going to be done to keep things like this from happening when these robots are in our homes.
Mm-hmm. That's breaking Asimov's first law of robotics, isn't it? You don't kill the person who invented you.
Well, and I think if a Roomba gets out of line, you pick it up and you smack it. Seriously. You know, they're less than 5 pounds. You turn them off. We don't envision any issues. They're built to be inherently safe. They won't fall down the stairs ever.
But they're not carrying a rifle either, are they?
We don't see a market for that in the homes.
No. but he had a serious question.
Yeah.
How do you ensure?
It's like any technology. If I can pipe
sure.
in here,
sure.
We're not planning to produce armed robots to live in a home. But if you look at any kind of technology, there can be accidents that happen with it, and technologies do go wrong. But we're not setting out to produce something mm-hmm. that's lethal and dangerous. Mm-hmm. And I think it's again looking at the risk benefit analysis of that. That if we can produce something that is going to make people's lives somewhat better, then it's worth doing. But we obviously do it in the safest possible way.
Dean, I know that you've spent your life helping people, you know, medically and physically to improve their lives. As our baby boomers, all of us among them, get older and older, do you see more robotic products coming out?
Yeah, there's no question there'll be more robotics projects and products. And the caller is, of course, right that any product can malfunction, and depending on the size and scale and power of the product, any malfunction of any product has a potential to do something surprising, and sometimes that surprise can be harmful. But again, as I said before, this idea that we imbue these things almost because of our own creativity with doing things for reasons or because of thought or soul or feeling or happiness or anger is just something we have to get over. I mean, if you stood next to a snowblower that's got to have 10 horsepower to do its job and big blades to pick up stuff and crush ice, and you accidentally get in front of it, or if it slips around on the ice and comes back and chops up your leg, that's a terrible accident, but nobody would say there was malice involved, that somehow this machine went through a thought process, turned around, and ate your leg. You would just say the motor's connected to the wheel, it was in drive, it went there, there was an accident, and by definition, the machine that was capable enough to do what you wanted it to do, A, could end up doing B. And you have to be very careful to put in safety systems and interlocks and all sorts of things to prevent accidents. And a robot that can point a gun or do anything that the caller is talking about needs to have the same interlocks, and he's completely right. If something goes wrong with any machine, it can do something bad, but you don't have to invent that it did it because somehow, unlike all the other machines we make, it was malicious or intentional. But machines that have lots of power can do lots of harm. You can, you know, a car gets out of control and kills mm-hmm. about 40,000 people a year. It's not an evil car. It was something that we tried to design better and better to eliminate accidents. He's exactly right. We need to do that. But to try to focus on the non-real emotional or intentional acts of machines is probably an inappropriate thing to focus on, and an unnecessary complexity to add to the debate. It doesn't exist.
We're talking about robotics this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Dale in Saginaw, Michigan. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. How are you?
Hi there. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say thanks for the show, and I listen to you every Friday on my way home from work. I'm a teacher.
Thank you.
I teach physics. And we have a robotics team, Team 49, in Saginaw, and it's our 11th year.
Team 49, you're a real veteran.
Yeah, well, not 16 yet, yeah. Mr. Kamen, but we're getting there. It's been an amazing program for our school, which is predominantly a minority school. We've had over 100 graduates, and out of that, 80% of them have gone on to study math, science, and engineering, while in our regular program, fewer than 3 or 4% have gone on to study any math, science, or engineering.
Do the other students look at your students as the geeks, you know, the weirdos, or instead of joining the football team or the basketball team or the soccer team or something like that?
Well, we have members of our team that are on all of those, but we actually have more people try out for our first team than we have try out for all of our sports put together. almost a third of our student body tries to get on our team every year.
Now, why is that?
I think the excitement, the fact that some of them see through our mentors from Dow Chemical Company that that it's possible for them to be engineers or scientists and make a good living and be excited about what's going on.
Do they draw in any of the borderline students who might be interested but are afraid to think they're not smart enough to be involved?
We have. We do, in fact. We have no grade point criteria for determining who can get on the team. What we look for is the excitement and the interest, and what's happened is that the kids that very many who are marginal have come in and been extremely successful.
Well, thanks for calling, and good luck to you, Dale.
All right, thanks.
1-800-999-8255. Interesting story. I'm sure it's not unusual, Dean, is it?
No, but I think the kind of data he just gave you, some of your listeners might dismiss as odd or a fluke, but you heard him. 80% of his students, over 100 students, have gone on from his school to careers in science and technology, where we desperately need more people in this country, and only 3 or 4% of the kids in the same schools that didn't participate in FIRST went on. And that is the kind of data we're getting from all the schools. And this year, if you include FIRST LEGO League, we have 13,911 schools involved. So we are starting, as our student pointed out to you, we're starting to become mainstream. And that's what I was intending all along, and that's very exciting. And he's right. I asked this year's homework assignment was get to media. That would be you, and help get our story out so that we can get more parents, more teachers, more companies, more sponsors, more foundations to take a look at FIRST and get involved.
Grant, what kind of robotics would you like to be involved in? Any specific?
Nothing really at the moment. When I was at FANUC, I was working on production line robots. Stuff like for car assembly lines, industrial type things, and I found that pretty interesting. They were, you know, fully autonomous paint booth robots and et cetera. But I enjoy the engineering aspect of things. You know, wherever my future employer takes me.
Well, we're going to have to send you one of our Sci-Fry pocket protectors when we get them handed out. I thank all of you for taking time to be with us today. Dean Kamen, founder of FIRST Robotics Competition for Young Inventors, Grant Cox, a member of the team Thunder Chickens, recently crowned world champions at the FIRST Robotics Competition. Also, Helen Greiner, co-founder and chairman of the board of iRobot. Peter McGowan is professor at the University of London and project coordinator for the group Living with Robotics and Interactive Companions. Thanks for staying up late for us, Peter.
Thank you.
All of you have a great weekend, and thanks for taking time to be with us. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. Surf over to our website if you want to see that robotics competition. We have a terrific video up there. You can watch how the contestants won that contest. Also, you can email us at Science Friday, and also at sciencefriday.com. We have blogs and podcasts and looking for your input and ideas about how to make Science Friday better. What kind of things would you like to do? Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.